This episode of Table Talk is sponsored by Berry Brothers and Rudd, Britain's oldest wine and spirit merchant. It isn't possible at the moment to go to your favourite restaurant because restaurants are closed. But Berry Brothers and Rudd have nobly stepped into the breach with their fantastic new at-home service. Berry's will send a magnificent three-course meal directly to your house, and they'll also provide the ideal wine or wines to go with the food. What a delicious idea. Go to spectator.co.uk/Berry Brothers to find out more.
Hello and welcome to Table Talk, the Spectator's food and drink podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast.
And I'm Olivia Potts.
And today we're delighted to be joined by Max Halley. Max is one of Britain's preeminent, or perhaps the preeminent, sandwich aficionado. His sandwich shop in Finsbury Park, Max's Sandwiches, is known in normal times for having elevated the humble sandwich to something much more exciting. His new book, Max's Picnic Book, is out now. Max, welcome to Table Talk.
Namaste. Thank you for having me.
Max, we're going to start where we always do with these podcasts, at the very beginning, and ask you, what are your earliest memories of food?
Ooh. Well, I've got lots, actually, because I got I was born in London, but when I was two, my little sister was born and my parents decided to decamp out of London to the countryside, and they moved to really quite rural Somerset and like bought a house with a big garden from this old couple called the Winches who'd lived there like 60 years or something. And Mrs. Winch was a mad vegetable gardener. And so my parents just like inherited this like sick vegetable garden. And so I grew up where like I remember even being really quite little and there was like a big patch of stuff that I realise now, like, you know, 30 years later or whatever, when I was working in a Michelin star kitchen, I was like, shit. So there was like a Jerusalem artichoke patch. There was asparagus. There was like globe artichokes growing everywhere, which my dad got obsessed with and started growing down the side of the lawn, and a greenhouse with figs in it. So I just remember being a little kid and just kind of going out into the garden and like picking gooseberries and, you know, currants, black currants, white currants, like I said, digging up Jerusalem artichokes, which I always knew was a sunflower, but obviously that's not common knowledge, I don't think. People think it's some kind of potato or something. And it's only called an artichoke because it smells, it has a similar taste to an artichoke. It bears no relation to it whatsoever. Girasole. Jerusalem is a corruption of girasole. Anyway, I don't know why I'm telling you that. Anyway, and so I remember picking Marmon tomatoes off plants when I was a little kid, and because there were some walls in the garden, like, it wasn't a walled garden, but there were bits of wall all over the gardens. And so there was like fig tree growing, well, in a greenhouse, but up against a wall facing south, and tomato plants up against the walls so that, you know, they stay warm through the night. And so I grew up like really going out into the garden and like picking and digging vegetables up and stuff and eating them. So I was eating, sitting in, my mum was just saying to me earlier, people used to think it was really weird when she'd take me down the shops in my little pushchair and I'd be sat in my pushchair eating a red pepper aged, you know, I don't know how old, like, how old are you in a pushchair? 1.5, 2 or something like that. And that I had no interest in the fizzy sweets that I have come to love. But as a little kid, I was eating like cucumbers and red peppers in my pushchair. Brilliant.
Dream child.
Yeah, so nice. And all because, yeah, my parents just moved to Somerset and inherited this garden. Super lucky.
Was your mum and your dad, were they cooking a lot with all these vegetables that were there?
Yeah, loads. Like, my dad's a wine journalist, so, and I has been, well, he's a journalist, but predominantly a wine journalist. And so I've kind of grown up in quite a foodie, winey world. You know, I remember like sneaking downstairs when my parents were having dinner parties and guzzling fish soup and things like that when I was a little kid. And like, I've been sort of really quite spoiled with a sort of plethora of amazing food stuff ever since I was little. I think, you know, I found out what deliciousness is early.
And do you think you took it for granted, or did you recognise early on that, like, there was good stuff to be had?
Yeah, well, I think as a result of the garden, I realised from an early age that it's a lot of work. That it wasn't just like, you know, there is just amazing fruit in the fruit bowl. It was like I'd have to go and help prune plants and dig things up and move stuff around. And so I don't know. I don't think I ever did take it for granted. I mean, hopefully, I don't think I still do now. But yeah, I realised that, it's a lot of work tending and nurturing things to make them as delicious as possible.
And when did you realise that perhaps your contemporaries weren't having the same experience as you were?
I don't know, because at school, I guess when people came round to play, like little friends, you know, what my mum would call my horrible little friends, would, you know, come round to play football in the garden or whatever it was. And my mum would be soaking haricot beans for us to cook tomorrow and all this kind of jazz. And like, because from such a young age, like my dad was going off on wine trips to Italy to write about wine and stuff and going to Provence and all this stuff and kind of coming back with like, oh my God, you're not going to believe what they do with lamb in Provence or whatever. And like, tapenade.
I reckon tapenade must be pretty mind-blowing the first time you encounter it.
It must be, mustn't it? I don't know, I had a Turkish girlfriend years and years ago, about 15 years ago or something like that. And I remember going, I mean, she lived in England. Her parents lived in England as well, but both parents were Turkish. And I remember waking up at her parents' house and going, I mean, I'd had tapenade before, but I'd go down to breakfast and they were all having toast and tapenade for breakfast. And I was like, shit, you guys are far out. Like, you know, I've seen those sort of the occasional Greek breakfast with a cheeky olive bouncing around somewhere, but like tapenade on toast at 8 o'clock in the morning with coffee.
It does sound quite an intense breakfast. And what were mealtimes like with your family, Max?
Nice. Winey affairs. Not that we were ever allowed wine. Apple juice and fizzy water, always. But, yeah, just jolly affairs. We always, if we weren't at school, we would always have lunch together. But I think my parents wanted us to, you know, bugger off to bed or whatever. So they could have the good downstairs and drink nice wine or whatever, like, without being annoyed. Like, I remember Saturday and Sunday mornings. My parents left London and moved to Somerset. They bought a house outside a town called Shepton Mallet, which, I don't know, one can't be too polite about Shepton Mallet. But it did have a deli, and I remember really being real young, like 4 or 5 maybe, and going to the deli in Shepton with my mum. And, you know, my mum chatting to the guys in the deli, and they used to give us those, do you remember those yogurt-covered raisins? The weird, like look like something you get in Revels or whatever. Anyway, and I remember they'd always give my sister and I yoghurt-covered raisins to eat in the deli while my mum bought, like, slices of chorizo and, I don't know, pâté and stuff like that. And when my sister and I used to wake up, obviously as a kid you wake up really early, don't you? And we used to go down to the kitchen, my sister and I, on Saturdays and Sunday mornings, and my mum would have left these little bags with chorizo and coriander sarnies.
Wow.
When we were really little. And, like, slices of chorizo from the deli, coriander and butter. And it was just so that we wouldn't go and bug my mum and dad in bed and we could watch the Gummy Bears or DuckTales or whatever it was on a Saturday morning and leave my folks alone to lie in.
Is that your earliest sandwich memory then?
Yeah, that is what I segued into the sandwich world with chorizo,
seamlessly,
butter and coriander. Pretty bougie, really.
Yeah, I don't think I had chorizo until I was about 20. That's very impressive.
No, you should have grown up in Shepton Mallet.
I'm afraid it was Sunderland. We didn't have chorizo breakfast sandwiches in Sunderland.
No, I don't think they do yet.
No. And Max, what was school? You mentioned school. What was school food like? Do you have happy memories of school food?
You know, I learned early on that if you put enough mustard on something, it tastes all right. So, like, I think condiments largely got me through school food. Like, you know, find Tabasco, Lee and Perrins and some mustard, pretty much anything's all right. I do have memories as well of doing, like, Brown Rice Day. I don't know, must have been some charity sort of I think the school did some thing where they donated the money for the day to some charity, and we just had brown rice. And all the kids were all like, oh, like up in arms, like, oh, brown rice is terrible. And I just remember thinking, like, if you cover it in malt vinegar, it's really not that bad.
It's really setting you up for your career there, isn't it?
Yeah, as a semi-professional condimenter.
So tell us about your, I mean, you're in this household with the most incredible vegetable garden, a father who is a wine journalist and travels a lot, and a mother who's clearly very interested.
Professional piss artist. Yeah.
Your words, not mine. And a mother who's clearly very interested in, like, good food and cooking. Were you just consuming at this point, or did you learn to cook at home?
I remember de-bearding mussels and, like, water with oats in it, with the mussels in it soaking to get all the grit out of them. And, like, yeah, we had to do all of that stuff. And I remember helping with lots of things. My mum had one of those, what are those things called? Mezzaluna.
Mezzaluna, yes.
And I remember having to go, getting sent to the garden, go get some parsley, come back, and I'd get to go with the mezzaluna to cut up. Like, my mum used to make clam spaghetti with, from the deli in Shepton Mallet, they sold tins of clams, and my mum would just make tomato sauce and then throw in a tin of these clams, not in the shells, but, and then I'd go and get the parsley from the garden to go on top of the clam spaghetti. I mean, it's all like, it's really being exposed to a real diverse array of stuff as well, which perhaps it does, like, God, you know, actually, to be honest, I never really thought, why do I work in the food industry? But it's like, that probably is why, isn't it?
And after school, you moved back to London. Did you kind of know that you wanted to go back into the world of food at that point?
Not really. I mean, like, I did an ancient history degree at university. And when I finished, I went and got a job in a publishing company. A bleak job, to be brutally honest. Phoning people up and selling classified advertising space in the back of a magazine that I knew didn't really work. But I was quite good at it. And I just, after like 3 months, I thought, like, this is terrible. Like, I shouldn't really be doing this. But I thought, like, I didn't know what to do. What do I do? Like, I've done a bloody ancient history degree. Relatively speaking, do anything, right? And I just realised that I hadn't really noticed, but that I was, like, going and finding little places in the offices of the publishing company were in Hammersmith, which, coincidentally, where I was born. I worked on the office on the same street that I was born at the top of. It was really weird. And I was, like, going finding little restaurants in Hammersmith and sitting on my own and having lunch. And I realised that really most of my days were just planning what to have for lunch and where to go and how to try and pay as little attention to my professional life as possible and to concentrate on having lunch and, you know, how to get back to the office on time or whatever. And that was when I quit my job and I just realised that I should get a job working in food. And my dad was much more like winey than foodie, really, in a professional capacity. So I couldn't ask my dad to hook me up with anyone, really. And I knew this one guy that I, like, still a dear friend of mine called Harry McIntosh, who owned a little tiny hotel in the Wye Valley, well, a pub with rooms, really, called the Ancient Camp Inn. And he was the only person I knew in the food business. And so I just phoned him up and said, can I come and work for you? They're like, it was just him and a kitchen porter, the lovely Matty, in the kitchen. And he was like, yeah, to be honest, the pub's getting busier and, like, Matty and I could do with a hand anyway and all this sort of stuff. And so I went down and, like, I just, like, shared a room with Harry for a year, and which was hilarious. And I never met anyone who falls asleep that fast. It's so weird. He'd just sit in his chair in the afternoon, straight out. Like, anyway. And snoring. Fantastic. And it was actually sort of like some kind of guest house nightmare. But anyway, yeah, so I shared a room with Harry. During the year that I worked with Harry, so I was 22 then, and I went and spent a year working with Harry. And Harry had, like, worked in restaurants in the south of France and gone to catering college in France and all this kind of stuff. I, like, really knew what he was doing. And in the course of the year working with him, he kind of put me through catering college, really, I suppose. And he'd, like, taught me how eggs work. What do you do when the hollandaise splits? How to fillet fish and butcher meat and all this stuff. And so then after I left Harry, I spent a year. I knew that I'd done the right thing and that I did want to work in the food industry, but I wasn't sure what yet. I thought what I'd do was go and work in other elements of the food industry and see, like, what were they like. So, like, I went and worked in a deli. I went and worked in a pudding factory, like, manufacturing desserts on quite a big scale. And like, I did loads of little bits and bobs jobs around the food industry to try and ascertain, like, get a picture of food in Britain as a whole. And then it took a good couple of years before I finally settled on restaurants as the bit of the business that, like, fundamentally I'm a hedonist and, you know, there's a lot more space for enjoying yourself owning a restaurant than growing cauliflowers or whatever it might be. No, don't get me wrong, like, I would love to grow cauliflowers now, but at the time I was a bit of a party boy. There was more fun to be had in restaurants.
I can imagine. And tell us about sandwiches. At what point did you suddenly realise that's what I want to be doing?
It was like when what was my last job before? I was working in this restaurant in Highbury and Islington called Le Coq. It was a rotisserie chicken restaurant. My friend Ben Benton and I worked, who now I've wrote the sandwich book with and have written the picnic book with. He was the head chef, I was the general manager. And I just thought that I just didn't want to work for anybody else anymore. I felt like I was... Ben and I had run Le Coq for the first year it was open, and it was... unfortunately, it has now closed down, a couple of years later. But when we left, it was flying. And I just felt like I'd been there involved in that project from before it opened and was there for the first year, 3 or 4 months before it opened, and just like hiring all the staff and all this sort of jazz. And I just, that made me realise, like, do you know what? I could do this myself. And so I quit, and I thought, like, Yanni Papoutsis had taken the burger the burger had already exploded in the US, but, you know, Yanni had taken the burger, which in Britain at that time, what, like 10, 12 years ago, whatever it was, that, you know, burgers were still something you got in the fish and chip shop and from the, the sort of the burger van or whatever. And Yanni put his tent up in a car park in Peckham and Meat Liquor was born. And he sort of, or Meat Easy or whatever it was called then. And, he kind of changed the burger. And like Carl Clark had taken fried chicken and done the whole, you know, and really like made it much more delicious, to be honest. Using better quality ingredients and all that stuff. And I was just thinking, like, what is there that is a bit like that? Something that has been woefully neglected. And I just thought, like, it's the sandwich. And so I thought, like, where's the best sandwich? Where's the best sandwich from? And it was like Pret, really. There's Fernandez and Wells had done some quite nice sarnies in the deli, sort of deli calf places in Soho. What was that? Oh, whatever street that is. You know, there was like Harrods actually did some quite nice sarnies. That when I was a student at university, me and my friend Ben, we used to live in Finsbury Park, and we used to get the 19 bus that would take you down to Harrods, and we'd get off the bus at Harrods at about 4:30 and go wander around the food hall as students at uni, pretending that we were going to buy something and like eating all the samples and stuff, because we knew at 5:00 they sold all the sandwiches for £1, and we would just load up on Harrods sandwiches. And so you come round to this student flat, they'd be like, Foster's, like post-apocalyptic student house scene, like overfilled ashtrays and like beer cans everywhere. And you open the fridge and there'd be like 50 Harrods sandwiches. It's so cool. Anyway, and yeah, so I just really, it was like Pret, Fernandez and Wells, like the food halls, you know, the Brass Rail at Selfridges and, you know, the Brick Lane bagel places. And that, I just realised, like, that is basically the sum total of banging sandwiches in Britain. And so what I did by then, I'd worked in the food industry for years. And so I knew loads of chefs and foodie people, whatever. And so I sent an email out to all these people in the food industry that I knew, saying, please send me a list of your five favourite sandwiches. And they were all BLT, chicken and bacon, avocado, and I just realised, like, shit, there is a... These are, like, some of these people got Michelin stars and stuff, and they still think a sandwich is, like, the best sandwich is chicken and bacon. And I was just like, there's a... Do you know what I mean? Like, there's a... Someone could do this, and maybe it could be me, that could, like, really think a bit more about what is going into these things and, like, what... how to build them better, what is the best bread, and, like, how much mayonnaise can you put in something, and all of the fun things in the world.
Tell us, Matt, about, because you have a, I think it's like a theory of sandwiches, isn't it?
Yes, I do.
About your theory of sandwiches.
Yes, I have a sandwich mantra that every sandwich we have ever sold in my sandwich shop adheres to, and that is hot, cold, sweet, sour, crunchy, soft. So it's basically the three great contrasts that are found within a plate of food, I guess, traditionally, or in the sandwich shop. And, you know, something hot, something cold. And straight away I'm thinking, like, that already sounds nice. And then, like, something sweet and something sour. Like, along with something hot and something cold. And then it's crunchy and soft. And you're like, there's not a great deal apart from salt. But that your brain really requires for something to be delicious. And that, when I figured that out, like, that's not breaking any new ground, man. Like, I have not, you could go to many great restaurants in the world and the contents of the bowl or plate of food that you are given are, if it is an excellent bowl or plate of food, often will contain those six elements. And when I realised, like, that I was really onto something with the sarnie, was I was thinking about actually the act of eating, the consuming of those things. So if you're a chef in a restaurant and you're serving your food on a plate, you've got, and you're like, hot, cold, sweet, sour, crunchy, soft, the problem you've got is that you cannot control how Muggins here consumes that plate that you've cleverly put together. You know, I might be yamming all the sweet stuff and then yamming all the crunchy bits, and then I'm just left with, like, hot sweet stuff. And that is not how you, the chef, intended that plate of food to be eaten. Whereas where I'm really lucky with the sarnies is that, like, we build, all the sarnies are built in layers so that every bite of every sandwich contains all six of those things. And I honestly think that is why they're so bloody delicious.
You serve all the sandwiches on the same bread.
Yes, we do.
Which is not sourdough bread, as no. is quite trendy. You have very strong opinions on sourdough bread.
Tell you might say I've been rather rude about it.
possibly. Tell us your preferred sandwich bread and how you came to that conclusion.
Yeah, focaccia, 100% is my preferred sandwich bread. It has a high percentage of crust and it's thick. You don't want thick and dry, but you want thick and soft. So it has. We use just, like, commercial yeast. We buy the yeast from Sainsbury's that we use at the sandwich shop to make our focaccia, because it's utterly and completely predictable. It never behaves differently. And what we want is quite a quick proof on the bread, so that you have a high volume of very small bubbles in the bread. And what that means is that a higher volume of liquid can be soaked into the bread without it falling apart. Mm-hmm. And that's why you want crust everywhere. So we bake our focaccias. I mean, we bake them massive in these huge,
like, gastro trays.
Yeah, exactly. And, like, a one-to-one gastro. So the focaccia is massive. We get 10 sandwiches out of one of those loaves. But the bread is a good, an inch and a half to even 2 inches high sometimes. And when you look at the sandwich, like if you, before you've eaten it, and you think like, shit, that's a lot of bread. And then actually, as soon as you go for it, it just gives in. And it's so soft and generous in terms of how much it's soaked up. And like, you know, you cannot put enough mayonnaise on to ruin it, which you could do with nearly anything. And that's what, like, sourdough, the sandwiches, like, you've got to be joking. It's got, the ferment is slow, so the air holes are massive, or the holes caused by the CO2 or whatever are massive. And like, how can you possibly want that for a sandwich? Like, you don't want holes, like, there could have been mayonnaise there, man. What are you talking about? And like, it gets too messy. It always rips and falls apart. Like, so for ketchup, that's why I often recommend to people that I'm not going to be one of these guys telling you've got to make your own bread to make a sandwich at home. Do you know what I mean? You can come to my sandwich shop if you want someone to have made you bread. But I always recommend people to use those little chia batters that they sell in the supermarket. You know, the little mini ones that sometimes have got the dodgy lines on. Those, they are fantastic because you've got such a high concentration of crust. So you can soak up more goo and condiment more heavily and maintain the structural integrity of the sandwich right to the end.
Bam! And that's tell us about the fillings, because you have quite an avant-garde approach to sandwich fillings.
To be honest, we've had many. The signature one is ham, egg and chips, because, which is, so braised ham hock, piccalilli, fried egg, shoestring fries, malt vinegar mayonnaise, which is literally just mayonnaise with loads of malt vinegar in it. Because when I opened, when I sent out that email, can you tell me your five favourite sandwiches to all these chefy foodie people that I knew, and I'd said, I want to open a sandwich shop, and I got back, I want to open a sandwich shop, open at night, and I got back all my hot sandwiches and booze. That's what it says on the sign outside. And like, since then, I've thought, like, if your brand can't sum up what it does in four words, you're doing something wrong. Hot sandwiches and booze. Everybody walking past knows what that gaff is. Like, you don't really need to know anything else. Probably swearing is probably like the only other relevant thing.
You do a good cup of tea during the day.
Banging cup of tea, but we're only open during the day on weekends, because it's one of the things that came back in the emails was people saying, like, a sandwich shop at night, how are you going to persuade people that something so fundamentally lunchy is something that they can have for their dinner? And I thought, there's two ways that I can do that. One is to only open at night, so if they want to come, they have to have it for their dinner. and the other one was to think of the fillings as things that people were comfortable with as plates of food, so that it was easier for the sandwich to be perceived as a meal. And that's why I did ham, egg and chips, because it was like, you know, it's like the archetypal pub lunch, isn't it? And that everyone likes ham, egg and chips. It's one of the greatest combinations of three things, as long as you get to cover everything in malt vinegar, hence the malt vinegar mayonnaise. You know, for me, that is, you know, one of my kind of death row-y meals. I love ham, egg and chips. Whenever I go to the pub now to have lunch, I turn up hoping that I'll be having ham, egg and chips for my lunch. So the ham, egg and chips, which was the first sarnie I came up with for the sarnie shop, was, yeah, I tried to think of it, and I still do, like, try to think of the fillings as a plate of food that is all that stuff banging together. Is that delicious? And then once I've reached something delicious, then I figure out how to try and put it into a sandwich. Oh, you can't have that because it's too wet, or, you know, whatever. You have to grate the gherkins, or I don't know. But yeah. And then I don't know what else. Spring rolls, that's a banger. Spring roll sandwich. Oh, every now and again, I have a really good idea. I was trying to be super lazy. So I went to Chinatown and bought loads and loads of frozen spring rolls. And I turned up at the sandwich shop. I was like, guys, I'm a genius. We don't even have to do anything. We'll just sling them out of the freezer straight into the fryer. And bam, we'll make a spring roll sandwich. And we did it. And to be honest, they were crap. And so I started pickling the stuff that you would get in a spring roll. Bean sprouts, cucumber slices, carrot, red chilli. And I was putting them into... I was using the Chinatown spring rolls and putting my pickles on top. And I just suddenly thought, like, hang on a minute, what am I doing? Like, I'm pickling the stuff that you would put in a spring roll. Really, we should just make spring rolls. And so then, you know, we did these, like, it's pickled. They're pickled spring rolls. So we take the pickles out of the liquor. We roll the pickles in a spring roll wrapper and we chuck it in the fryer. And, like, they are a revelation. And... then that's why it's one of the sarnies I'm most pleased with, because it's technically veggie and so easy to make vegan now that vegan mayonnaise is really quite passable. Like that Hellmann's stuff is really not bad at all. And we blend up fermented black beans, fermented black soya beans. I don't know if you've ever had those. They kind of taste like, I mean, it's what you get in beef and black bean sauce and stuff. But if you eat them as they come, like out of the pack, they taste like sort of dark chocolate and Bovril and stuff like that. They're amazing, like almost desserty. And we blend those up with honey and MSG and mix that in mayonnaise and put that in the spring roll sandwich. I like mayonnaise top and bottom, thank you. Like that, I love that sarnie because it's like, it tastes like meat and it's vegan. Like, it's so cool. Oh, wait, it's honey vegan, actually. I don't know if vegan is... I don't know if honey is vegan.
It's a debate, isn't it?
I think no. Some vegans will eat honey, but it is technically not. If we're
Well, it's nearly vegan. It's all you want from
pretty
me.
Close. Pretty close.
So, I mean, I can't even imagine how many sandwiches you must have eaten during your lifetime, particularly the last decade. We often ask what comfort food is. Is sandwich still a comfort food for you, or is it just work?
No, God no. It's a lifelong love. And look, it's like the whole world agrees with me. It's like you would struggle to find a cuisine anywhere on the planet that doesn't wrap stuff in gluten. Do you know what I mean? Like, be it the bao in Taiwan, or, you know, whatever, kebabs in Istanbul. Like, these are all fundamentally really just sandwiches, aren't they? Comfort food, I don't know. Do you know what? Bread and butter with lemon juice on it is one of my things that just pleases me greatly and makes me feel like everything's going to be all right. So does salami, especially when accompanied with some kind of pickled thing, preferably a small member of the cucumber family. Yeah, I don't know. I know there's lots of things. Like, I got a... when I'm feeling not all right with the world, as I, you know, as one sometimes does, I tend to go and see my sister and we have roast chicken, rice and coleslaw. And then the darkness begins to lift and I start feeling like probably everything is going to be all right.
Yeah, roast chicken has that effect, I think.
Doesn't it?
And what about sweet things? Do you have a sweet tooth?
Yes, I do have a sweet tooth. Fizzy, I love fizzy sweets. I don't care what they are, from strawberry, cola bottle, whatever. Just get it in me. I guess it's just citric acid. It probably comes more from an obsession with sourness, actually. But obviously, as discussed in said sandwich theory, sourness in combination with sweetness really is one of the most delicious things in the whole world. And so, yeah, I love fizzy sweets. And then, Snickers ice creams. Love yeah. Snickers ice creams.
So good.
If you told me now that you were going to send me off to Veritas or whatever it is in Switzerland and have me put down the last thing I would want to eat before the injection would be a Snickers ice cream.
Well, that actually is often our last question, Max. So you've kind of answered it for us.
Oh, didn't I? Sorry.
No, that's great.
We'll just kill it there, if you know what I'm saying.
I think I probably know the answer, but if you had to choose one of your sandwiches, could you?
Yeah,
it's got to be the ham, egg and chips.
Yeah, ham, egg and chips. You know, I know which way my bread's buttered. Although we never butter bread in the sandwich shop because we're too busy putting mayonnaise. Yeah.
Just mayonnaise.
Mayonnaise, yeah. You see, I almost feel like butter is is an element of a sandwich. Like, you'd say, like, oh, it's got this and this and butter. And then, but I think, like, with mayonnaise, I wouldn't do that. I'd just be like, you know, a BLT has got bacon, lettuce and tomato. The mayonnaise is so integral. Obviously, that clearly should be called the BLTM, right? Or the mayonnaise is so important. I don't know why they name it. But it's because mayonnaise is so integral, you don't need to name it. It should just be there all the time.
Max, thank you so much for joining Table Talk and giving us all those great tips on sandwiches. And Max's new book, Max's Picnic Book, is out now.
Thank you for joining us on the Spectator's Food and Drink podcast. For more recipes, food history, stories and drinks, you can head to the Spectator website. La pauvre fleur disait au papillon céleste, ne fuis pas.